across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Another DUP minister meets the LCC. Gordon Lyons this time. That'll come up on the programme this morning. And the Boyne Bridge. How can a bridge be so interesting? Well, people are telling us why and how. All coming up this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! The UVF and the UDA can help you. Maybe there is a grey area because these people are transitioning. Maybe we should understand why they still have the need to put on a balaclava and daub racist slogans across buildings, driving out people with a different colour skin than them from local communities. Don't worry, the UVF and the UDA can help you. Maybe we should just think about it as a transitioning move, that they're walking into businesses and looking at local community entrepreneurs and telling them, pay up or we'll burn you out. Maybe it's actually right that we stand back, 26 years later, and say it's all right, they need more time to stop shooting people in the knees. They need more time to stop turning young people into zombies with drugs. Give them more time. Let them transition. We understand that they need more time to stop being criminals. Transitioning. What does it mean 26 years later? Is it a farce? Or actually, is it good that the DUP, the biggest unionist party in Northern Ireland, are still trying to reach out to the people who have influence over those paramilitaries and get them to put their guns, their violent criminality to the side? Why are we talking about this morning? The Umbrella Group, and the Umbrella Group, the LCC, are not the UDA and UVF. They are not. They're a group that was actually set up by government to try to get these people to transition. So we need to say that at the very top of this programme. But the LCC represent the views of the UDA and UVF. That's what they do. So when we have now a second minister, Gordon Lyons, meeting up with the LCC, and therefore the views of the UVF and the UDA now filtering into our minister about social housing, you think to yourself, hold on a minute, social housing? Who gives a damn what the UDA and UVF think about social housing? Are they the same people that intimidate people out of their homes? The UDA and UVF? Are they the same people that say, if you're not a prod, get out, or else? When Minister Gordon Lyons is meeting with the LCC, is he telling them, here, tell the UDA and UVF they need to stop? Well, the Communities Minister has issued a statement about this, having met the LCC, and told us that the meeting was arranged at the request of the LCC. Minister Lyons emphasised at the meeting that politics and democratic processes are the only way that we will succeed in shaping Northern Ireland and dealing with the challenges we face. Is that sending out that message? I know that's Gordon's words. But when the LCC get this access, what message does it send out? 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. Two DUP ministers now in recent times meeting up with the LCC. The Education Minister, Paul Given, met the LCC on their request, and now Minister Lyons, another DUP minister. The Belfast Telegraph political editor, Suzanne Breen, was on Nolan Live on BBC One last night.
Well, clearly Paul Given wasn't on a solo run. A few weeks ago when he met the LCC, Gordon Lyons meets them despite all the controversy that Paul Given meeting brought about. This is DUP policy. Arlene Foster met them. Edwin Poots and his short reign met them. Geoffrey Donaldson met them. And we have to call this out. We have to call out what the LCC are. They're a bunch of men representing another bunch of men who are involved in intimidation, in extortion and in drug dealing, and they shouldn't be anywhere near
people who are
running this country.
That's not everybody in the LCC, is it? You've got David Campbell, who says he's wedded to peace. He's trying to get them to stop. But the LCC deliver messaging, which is the thinking of the UVF and UDA. And the NIO have met the LCC in the past.
And that doesn't make it right. And in those organisations are people who are involved in all sorts of awful criminal activity. And let's put it like this. If Sinn Féin went out and met Saru, met the political representatives of the new IRA, I would say that Stormont would come down. It would collapse. The DUP would no longer be in government with Sinn Féin. Yet everybody is supposed to turn a blind eye to this.
The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, told Buckler and Gamu last week that you cannot turn your back on people who are transitioning.
We're not talking about paramilitaries, we're talking about people who are involved in transitioning communities. That's what they were established to do, to reduce the harm, to reduce the grip of paramilitaries. Okay. And as a political leader and somebody who wants to see Northern Ireland progress, we will do that when we engage, not when we turn our backs on people.
How, Gavin, are we not talking about people who are paramilitaries when the views of the UDA and UVF are being expressed? Gavin Robinson, what are? I know you're against illegality. I know you're against paramilitaries. But what are your specific views on criminals who are transitioning? Should they be locked up? If you're against criminality, you must think that, right? How long are you going to let these people say that they're transitioning for? It is clearly a key question for law-abiding people in this country who park in a clear way and get a parking ticket immediately. Like, where is this at, Gavin? Are we going to be saying, in 10 years' time, oh, don't worry, they are still transitioning and they're still getting the money that comes with transitioning? Maliki in Belfast, first call of the day. Good morning.
How you doing, Stephen? I just listened to the TV show last night. It really frustrates me. And, you know, and as I say, people are well aware of my circumstances, and I don't want to go on about it like a broken record, but the bottom line is the UVF or the UDA or loyalist paramilitaries intimidated me out of a business in Belfast, which between the thieving, the pressure on paying them protection money, the threatening my family, I ended up going into bankruptcy, which in turn had the insolvency people on to me about today, 7 years later, trying to repossess my house and evict me from my home, all because I couldn't cope with the threats and the intimidation from loyalist paramilitaries.
Well, is Gavin Robinson saying, is the DUP saying that the people who did that to you, there's no doubt they're saying they should be locked up, right? No doubt. Let's be fair to him. There's no doubt the DUP would describe those people as criminals. But are they also saying that if that was being done with the word, with the nod, with the wink of the UDA or UVF, that at the same time as calling them criminals, we've got to understand that they're transitioning? Is that what the DUP is doing?
Well, that brings me to the next point. Should I be contacting, because I've contacted every MP, every radio show in the country to try and help me, and yourself included, who has done a lot putting out my story. So should I go to Gavin Robinson tomorrow and tell him, the next time you're talking to the LCC, who are the representatives of these thugs who put me out of business and the state is now trying to put me out in the street, should I tell him, Gavin, when you're talking to them and they're talking about getting people local housing and stuff like that, are you going to ask them on my behalf? They put me out of my house, so now can they get me in their house? Like, do you understand what that does to someone like me, who was a law-abiding citizen, who employed people? These thugs are trying to, have got me nearly put out in the street, and now I have to go with a begging bowl to the DUP in Stormont and ask the minister, to ask the very people that done that to me, could they help me, or can they do something for me? Why don't they just stop giving them the money? And then the money that they're giving these thugs, that they could give some of that money to me, that I can then pay off the debts that I got because of them, and then everything would be, the circle would be squared.
Remind everybody what they did, the EVF, was it EVF or UDA? What did they do to you?
Well, they just did, what they did was they threatened me with phone calls. They stole money off me. They run my business underground. They threatened my children. They threatened to burn the place to the ground. They threatened to burn the house to the ground. I was getting a police escort home. And eventually, I was beaten up with baseball bats and put out of business. All because of their threats and intimidation. And because of that, that put my home to the revenue that they decided, right, we'll come after him and go after his home. And I think it's totally unfair, totally unjustified. And now I hear that one of our government ministers is speaking to these people about a housing crisis.
Two of them.
Unbelievable.
Paul Given, the education minister, Gordon Lyons, another DUP minister. Now they're telling the LCC that criminality is wrong. They're telling the LCC that UVF and UDA have got to disband. The LCC are not paramilitaries.
But, Stephen, the thing about your show, and it highlights this, and you get Brayson talking about this as well, they always come on and say, anybody that has any information about loyalist paramilitaries, or any paramilitaries, no matter, go to the police, and they should go to the police. That's where they should do it. But every dog in the street knows, and especially people in loyalist areas, if you go to the police and complain about an intimidation threat or a money handover, the police back away from that, and you are going to end up, and you said it before in your show, either badly beaten or burnt out. And these boys can talk their blue in the face about going to the police and saying, report it to the cops. That is not going to happen, and no ordinary human being is going to do that. Until the police knuckle down and go in and get these guys, then it'll stop. How do you think I feel when I see boys going around in £100,000 Range Rover cars or fancy holidays or homes in Spain? And I, a citizen who've worked hard to employ both sides of the community, I'm getting hammered. And these boys are sitting, driving past me and putting a finger up to me. And the state is letting that happen.
Well, despite Maliki, the DUP saying that what they want to be doing going forward is deal with bread and butter issues. We have asked the DUP last night to engage this morning with people like you, and they haven't done so.
No chance of doing that, Stephen. The ordinary punter,
they didn't even
like
reply. They didn't even reply.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I would have to stand at the gates of Stormont, which I'm prepared to do, by the way. You know, if push comes to shove.
Why don't you go up to Stormont and put a balaclava on, say you're transitioning? You might get a meeting.
100%. You're absolutely right. And I've often said, you know, are they going to turn around to the UVF? Because apparently, you know, the last DEP guy, I can't remember his name, he was speaking to them about transitioning. Does it mean that when they talk about jobs and work in loyalist areas, is the UDA, and I'm being facetious here, is the UDA and UVF going to teach people how to use baseball bats, how to threaten people, how to get money off people, and then call that an apprenticeship, and then the government will give them money to help them bring on apprentices? Is that what we're doing too?
Stay there for me. The Lance MLA, Sian Mulholland, with us this morning. Sian, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Look, Northern Ireland is a complex place. You can't, you cannot wish these people to go away. So clearly the DUP's position is that they will engage with the LCC about policy issues for our community, and that might help some of the people who the LCC speak on behalf of go away forever.
Stephen, we don't have a problem in Northern Ireland with transition. We have plenty of organisations and people within those organisations who have positively impacted their communities by transitioning already. If these organisations want to show that they are transitioning away from criminality and coercion, they can do that by not being involved in criminality and coercion. The issue here is not who they're speaking to. It's the fact that they have been awarded a platform that others who are working proactively in those communities that are impacted by poverty, social deprivation, education underachievement are not getting the same platform. And that's not right. And we have to tackle the root causes of why these organisations have control in their communities, and that hasn't been done for a long period of time. We haven't had the political leadership that has actually pushed through agendas on tackling poverty, on tackling drugs, on tackling illegal money lenders. If we can actually get the political leadership in the room to actually tackle those issues, those key issues that are really driving communities into despair, then I think that we can then move away, take away their control. Why are they getting platforms with a minister when other organisations are not getting that same platform?
Your party, Sian, supported the release of paramilitary prisoners. Your party were among other parties too, obviously, but your party supported giving paramilitary prisoners a free pass, in some people's eyes, to go back into the community, their crimes forgiven, and off they would go. Some of them into the heart of our government.
Stephen, so, we have never shied away from the fact that difficult decisions had to be made in the name of actually bringing peace here. We've never shied away from that. That was a horrendously difficult decision. And I think of every victim and every family who was impacted by that decision. It wasn't easy, but that was part of an agreement. We are 26 years on from that, Stephen. If not now, when? If not now, when? How long do we have to wait? And if you can hear anger in my voice this morning, it's because there is. I am so angry, and I'm a former youth worker. I have had correspondence over the last 12 hours from youth workers, from anti-poverty campaigners who are all saying this should not be happening. We have asked for meetings and we have been denied. I named them this morning on Gamu. So the Equality Coalition represents over 100 organisations who are fighting for a better community within their communities. The likes of Invisible Traffic, Stop Attacks, all of those groups, Stephen, who are actively working in communities.
Have any of those groups that you're talking about, have they actually written to DUP ministers and said, please, can we meet up?
Yes. So the anti-poverty, the group that was involved in the co-design of the anti-poverty strategy has written to the minister to ask for a meeting. Now, he's been in place, is it 9 months, 8 months? They're yet to have that meeting. Meetings were denied.
Which minister are you talking about?
The Department for Communities. I sit on the Communities Committee. Gordon Lyons. They have not had that meeting. The Women's Policy Group, who are involved in the co-design of the Gender Equality Strategy, have had their meetings denied. The groups that are involved in the strategies, the social inclusion strategies, have not been able to meet the minister. So I'm asking, and I will be asking in committee, which incidentally I'll be running off to in the next half an hour. I'm going to be asking at committee for information on what organisations have actually officially written to the minister who have either been denied or are still waiting on the long finger to meet with him, and why the LCC were prioritised above those meetings that would have come in. And I know for a fact that the Equality Coalition has written to the minister well before the summer. It was on our agenda in correspondence that was received to us as a committee over the summer, that they had received no inclination of a meeting from the minister over the 6 month period.
Well, he's busy. He's a minister. He's busy. He can't meet everybody.
He's busy.
He can't.
Stephen, we cannot legitimise this. These are organisations who are working at the cold front of poverty, deprivation and social isolation. They have asked the minister for meetings and they have been denied, and yet the minister has prioritised an organisation that includes the voices of illegal organisations, that is politically legitimising the coercion and exploitation that is being faced in our communities right now today. And that, in my view, is not acceptable.
Shannon, we've got to go. Thank you for being on this morning. John in Belfast. Morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen. I think people are missing the point about some of these meetings. I mean, if these people have anything to say about education or economic development, I mean, which I'd be really amazed to hear what that would contribution be. But if they have, why would they not meet a permanent secretary or a principal officer in the Department of Education or somewhere? And the fact that they're meeting the minister is a political statement. They could meet some, even if they have something to contribute, they could meet people at a lower level, but they're meeting the top guy. And that is a political statement when you get to meet the minister.
What do you mean, political statement?
Well, the DUP has lost ground, as everybody knows, to the likes of the TUV. So to keep the right side of the how would you describe it, the harder line people in loyalist communities, you bring in the legs of the LCC. That's really what it's about. So the DUP are saying we're keeping in with the boys, you know, so everybody can see that.
What about, John, those people who have a view that actually the LCC engaging in conversations about education is a good thing? The LCC being interested in schools in their community, you know, weaponizing loyalism with education, weaponizing young people with understanding that being able to politically argue your view rather than being tempted into paramilitarism is a good thing.
I wouldn't. I mean, there's nobody would argue with that. But why do they meet the minister in these high profile ways? Why don't they meet the permanent secretary or the principal officer, for instance, in the Department of Education, who has particular responsibility for this? And I go back to my original point. It is about the DUP making a statement saying, "Look, we're keeping the right side of these guys," and that's what it's about. And the thing about transitioning, because as a caller to your program a number of months ago, if I'm getting paid £30,000 a year during this transition process, what on earth would I ever? When would I ever say it's over? Well, when I lose my £30,000 a year?
Well, that's why.
Why would I ever say it's over?
That's why I am directing a question publicly on this program to the leader of the DUP, Gavin Robinson. When, in his view, should the transitioning opportunity end? Is it endless? Or is there a firm date in his head where his party will say publicly, it's over, no more transitioning opportunity?
Yes, and what's the incentive for me if I'm getting paid a salary during this transition process? What is the incentive for me June 2025, that's it over, transition's all finished.
But John, if he answers that question,
salary ends.
If he answers that question, and if other political parties answer that question, that there will be a defined, definitive date after which every party or whichever parties want to support it say they will not support any more transitioning money, it will end. If there's a defined, definitive date, do you think that would be effective?
Well, I think it would be an ideal position to get to. As I go back to what I say, the DUP don't want to lose any more ground in hardline unionist communities. So what they do is they have these high profile. There's no one in the world thinks that the LCC and some of the people they represent don't have much to say about the education system. My God, give me a break. I mean, there's people who are experts in this area have something to say, and they're not from any community. They're just experts in this area. But the guys who come around that table, and we know who some of them are. They're the old school. The guys who are causing, you know, a lot of problems on the street and stuff have no affiliation with the guys who are meeting in the LCC. These guys are all the other side of 60. They have these prominent positions, but there's no connection with the guys around the community.
John, thank you.
Okay.
Let's speak to former DUP Special Advisor David Graham. Good morning to you, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Former Labour Special Advisor Kevin Marr. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So, David, what is the DUP strategy here? What do you think they're at?
Well, look, I think, Stephen, it's quite clear that the DUP recognise that within, traditionally working class loyalist areas, particularly in urban parts of Northern Ireland, there is two big problems. Number one, there's a very significantly lower turnout of voters than in comparison to the mirror image across the political divide in Northern Ireland. And secondly, there's an even lower amount of people who are even registered to vote. So there's an apathy within loyalist communities that I believe is there for, 30, 40 years. And part of that problem will be some communities have failed to, as we've used the word, transition. Now, why has that happened? There are a lot of areas with really strong community development groups who, let's be honest, are built upon people who have perhaps been released early under the Belfast Agreement, people with a past in paramilitarism. But I think now, Stephen, we've got an issue where And I said to you on your programme last night, there's a media narrative around, you know, the, well, loyalist bad guys. We don't have any dissident loyalists. And I think that, you know, there are people involved in criminality right across Northern Ireland. And, I mean, the paramilitary task force has been set up to deal with them.
Did you hear Malachy this morning? In fact, wait there 1 second. Kevin, I'll come to you 1 second as well. Let's get the news back straight back to this in just a second. Did you both hear David Graham, Kevin Maher and people who are contemplating phoning in this morning? And the politicians, the political leaders that listen to this programme every day, I wonder, did they hear Malachy, our first caller on this morning, describing how he faces bankruptcy, he faces financial ruin, because the paramilitaries insisted he would pay up, beat him up, destroyed his business. I wonder how they feel when they hear someone like that needing to tolerate there's a grey area around transitioning, Kevin Maher.
I thought Malachy's tale was absolutely compelling, and the way he put it across, you know, was just jaw-dropping, really. The fact that we've normalised something that is not normal. I mean, the LCC was set up, as you say, as everybody keeps saying, to transition loyalist paramilitaries into the political mainstream. That's a perfectly good aim. But it's failed. It's failed. All that's happened is we've embedded them. They've become the LCC is effectively a trade body for loyalist godfathers. We can't have that in any kind of democratic society. You made the point earlier, Stephen, at the start of the programme. We're 26 years on from the Good Friday Agreement. How long do we have to wait? I mean, you know, this is we're measuring the kind of political process here now in decades, and yet here we are with people that are still committed to nefarious activities.
The LCC are set up to try to get the paramilitaries to end, aren't they?
And they failed. And they failed to do it. I mean,
yeah, but it doesn't mean that they are not. There are representatives of the UDA and UVF on that LCC. There absolutely are. But David Campbell, for example, is not one of them, and he would say that he's spending his time trying to get these people to understand violence is not the way forward.
Well, he's like, obviously failed, hasn't he? He's obviously failed.
But the UDA and UVF, they're not going to read some type of poetic, shiny textbook. Maybe the DUP are getting down and dirty to try to save life and protect property here.
All the DUP are doing is legitimising terrorist organisations.
They would deny that.
Well, that's I'm afraid the dogs in the street can see it for what it is. Now, you know, I heard David there a minute ago talk about, you know, the problems that exist within loyalist communities. And, as a left winger, I'm perfectly sympathetic to issues about housing and employment and education and underachievement. Absolutely. But whose fault is that? It's the DUP that represents these constituencies, these people. It's the DUP that have failed them. It's the DUP that have sat up there on the hill and not delivered for their people. They've created a space for the paramilitaries and the LCC to exist. It's a lot of this is down to the DUP's failure. And the DUP can fix some of this now by saying, enough, lads, you've got to enter the democratic process. You've got to come in from the cold. We've got to set a deadline for your transition to peaceful and exclusively democratic means. Now, this is a point this made this morning by John Kyle, former PUP deputy leader, in a report that's come out this morning. Set a deadline, and if nothing happens, turn off the taps. Turn off the taps. It's the public money that is the leverage here.
Stephen, I think part of the issue we have when you're talking about legitimising paramilitaries, you know, the difficulty we have here, if you look at it from a balanced point of view in Northern Ireland, we have allowed the IRA to be legitimised through early release of prisoners in 1998. We have built Stormont upon putting people into high positions of power and influence right up to the Deputy First Minister level, who had a long and influential career within the IRA. And I think part of the problem, I mentioned last night, where when David Irvine sadly passed away at a young age, no one has replaced and filled that vacuum within loyalist communities. And I think part of our difficulty is that we lump everyone within a working class loyalist background as a paramilitary and therefore a criminal, therefore a drug dealer, therefore
nobody does that. Who does that?
Stephen, but this is what is happening. The narrative here, if you consider, so if you take, and I'm not here to
Stephen,
speak
it's just
on behalf
not.
Of
you
them.
Can be a law-abiding loyalist, can't you?
But Stephen,
the vast
I'm
majority
to...
of loyalists are law-abiding. We are talking about a specific group of people here who feel that they can get away with being in the UDA and UVF
because
they just say, we're transitioning. Send us a few quid there because we're transitioning.
if you see former prisoners, the likes of Russell Watton, who's now the PUP leader, the likes of Jackie McDonald, who's been influential and publicly saying you can't be a loyalist and be a drug dealer, who have handed people over to the police that have been involved in criminality. I think our difficulty is here that we're dealing with an issue of people who have political influence, who have genuine desire to enhance and deal with all the issues that Kevin has just outlined, and in the same sentence, look at and separating it with criminality. And that's what the paramilitary task force was set up for.
Kevin, so, you know, let me put this point to you and to everyone else. Governments around the world, government here in Northern Ireland, spends millions. They will spend millions trying to get clear messaging to the public about a whole range of issues. You know that. You also know that it is incredibly difficult to get clear messaging into the public sphere. There is so much on social media. There is so much disinformation. There are so many people trying to seduce young people into all sorts of wrongdoing. And we have a situation in Northern Ireland where Gavin Robinson is saying you cannot turn your back on people that are transitioning. That means you cannot turn your back on people who are still criminals. I get it is a complex issue, but to be in one of these organisations is a criminal offence. So where is the responsibility in this country to push out clear messaging in a world where it's incredibly difficult to do it?
The communities from which these organisations spring are represented at every level in councils, at Stormont, in Westminster, invariably by DUP politicians. First of all, the failure is theirs. They need to own that. They need to be saying to their communities that we have a democratic process and that is it.
Well, they are saying that.
Well, why are they meeting then with representatives who operate in a parallel world, in a dark world, in a world where ultimately the threat of violence still exists? We can't have that in a democratic society. We just can't have it. You know, if somebody made the point earlier, look, if Sinn Féin ministers were meeting with hardline dissident Republicans, the balloon would go up, quite rightly. They should be completely out of our political system. But let me just give you this point.
And it's important I interject here. On that very point, it is the latest security assessment from the PSNI is that the Army Council controls Sinn Féin. So that you cannot look at Northern Ireland in terms of this poetic utopian place where we all run around singing Kumbaya. The biggest nationalist party, the First Minister's party, according to the latest security assessment, is controlled by the Army Council.
I think I would be the first to point out Northern Ireland is hardly a normal political system. Let's be clear about that. But is the Army Council waiting in the Minister's outer office to have a meeting to say that to lobby for its particular hobby horse? That is not happening.
But I think
organisations that should not exist are meeting legitimate government ministers. We can't have that. It's the equivalent of Angela Rayner meeting with the EDL. That would never happen.
Stephen's just said that there's clear independent assessment that the Army Council controls Sinn Féin. So we can't then have any more black and white terms. That your way of passing that off is, oh, Northern Ireland's not a normal society. But what Stephen's just said there is that people who are involved in 35 years of terrorist activity in this country, the fragments of that, the elements within that that have survived over the last 25 years of so-called peace are influencing the policy of a party who have been in the news for the last 2 weeks because of their amateur approach to how they deal with child protection issues. So, you know,
I wouldn't go there, David, if I were you. People in glass houses.
No.
Sir, I'm not in a glass house. I'm just providing a balanced view that I'm making the point here that fundamentally the DUP or Sinn Féin have been in the news for their amateur approach to A, child protection issues, BHR issues.
And the DUP as a political party are very, very clear what their views are towards any child abuse whatsoever, and it is that it is abhorrent and they will do everything they can to stop it. Stuart's in Castlewell. Morning, Stuart.
How are you?
Go ahead, Stuart.
Listen, see the UDA especially, they will never leave the scene, and I will tell you why. Because see, they'll leave the scene, they'll not be able to control the drug rackets no more. And then if they can't control the drug rackets, how can they go out and buy their big fancy cars and their wives or their mammy suits? So they're sitting crying that the unionist community is in disrepair and all this, that and the other. Why? Because they're flooding kids with drugs, getting kids addicted to drugs at a young age. And then that goes on through their whole life. So as much as it costs in the state to help these kids get over their drug problems, with their drug problems, they're not getting educated in school, then they're not going to get jobs. So why is the unionist community in the way it is? The only reason why the unionist community is the way it is because them scumbags won't go away. And the only reason why they won't go away is because they won't have control of the drugs. And if they were to go away and stand down, who would protect them? And again, these people are selling their filth in the street, flying around in their big fancy cars, and then they're going and meeting the top of the government. How does that look to the rest of the people in the unionist community? It makes them even more scared to speak out against them. And when you do get someone that speaks out against them, what happens to them? Their lives are destroyed, and the police take the flipping paramilitary side.
Well, no, the police don't take the paramilitary side, Sharon.
Really? Well, yeah. You said yourself, your man Malachy. What about him?
Well, the police
they turn a blind eye far too often.
How much of a grip? The police aren't turning a blind eye, and there's a paramilitary task force, and the police go after these people. How much of a grip?
Up the chain of command, always will push it onto the carpet.
No, they don't push it onto the carpet. They just don't do that. No, they do not. Stuart, how much of a grip do these paramilitary groups have on the community you live in?
Too much. Far too much.
What do they do?
Look at the drugs they're knocking out. Look at the fear they're putting into people for speaking out against them. Look at shop owners. How are they supposed to, in this economic climate, it's already hard enough to make a living. How are they supposed to pay these, that's what they are, drug dealers as well? It's a physical impossibility.
Well, look,
and when you have top government people meeting known drug dealers.
Well, they're not meeting known drug dealers. They are.
Well, I know for one. They definitely.
Hold on a second. We can't start getting in a live radio program, Stuart, to names of people. What we do know is that the Loyalist Community Council, it is set up to get paramilitary groups. One of the goals is to get paramilitary groups to transition into peaceful means. The question this morning is, how long should they be given? And Stuart, I will come back to you now. Look, in terms of transitioning, we played the clip of Gavin Robinson speaking to Buckler about you can't turn your back is the view of the DUP on people who are transitioning. Do you think a firm deadline would help, Stuart, or is it just unrealistic?
Well, it needs to be done. They need to be told. It's one or the other. Can't have both worlds. You cannot live in both worlds. What does that say to the rest of the kids? Oh, if I become a drug dealer, if I become a gangster, I get all the stuff given to me? Because that's the only impression young kids are seeing now.
Stuart, thank you. Good morning. 030-30-80-55-55. David Brooks is a DUP MLA. DUP don't want to speak to you this morning. David was speaking at an education committee 2 weeks ago. Let's hear what he said.
What I would say is I'm getting quite sick of, actually, in terms of political discourse, is this this sort of circus arriving every time there is engagement with the LCC. The LCC, as I understand it, is a body that is about moving loyalist paramilitaries away from paramilitarism, away from criminality, and moving in a better direction. But irrespective of that, I sit in this committee, and I sit across the way from Pat Sheehan and Pat Sheehan's history and everything that goes with that. I sit in the chamber across the way from Gerry Kelly, a man who's written a book about his history and what he has been responsible for. And when there are fly protests in the past, political unionism is accused of not engaging with loyalists and loyalist working class communities and hammered for that, for example. When we look at the history, people talk about the Hume Adams talks and talk about the virtue in that and how it brought Sinn Féin in from the cold and led the put the road ahead for the peace process and so on. Now, I won't necessarily share a lot of those views, but it seems a particular attitude is taken whenever political unionism talks to representatives of loyalism. And I think it's a double standard. I think it's something that even within the communities that I represent, they're sick of it. I think there are times whenever it is appropriate that we talk to the LCC. We don't always agree with them. We won't always share the same view as them, but depending on the issue. But there are times whenever, in order to assist with issues within our communities, it is right that we engage with them. And I will not personally apologise for our party engaging with the LCC whenever we are expected. And other parties expect us to sit in political chambers with people who are from a Republican background and have a history of violence.
So when that DUP MLA talks about representatives, David Brooks, so when, David, you talk about representatives of loyalism, it's a very broad term, isn't it? Is there no threshold of criminality that stops people having access to your party? Like, would the DUP go into the sex offenders wing of McGabbery and gather up all the loyalists who are sex offenders and say, we're interested in what your views are about building a school? You wouldn't, would you? So what type of criminality is acceptable in this bar of people who are transitioning? And that's what I'm trying to work out, and I keep on saying it. The LCC's been going 9 years, 2015. And I'm trying to understand, and I want your party to help us understand, David and Gavin and Gordon and Paul, I want us to understand what your views are as to how this can help. Help us understand. Brian in Belfast. Morning, Brian.
Good morning, Steve. I just want to make a wee quick comment on listening to your radio, obviously. It was mentioned by you from the PSNI that the Army Council runs Sinn Féin. Well, I mean, I voted for Sinn Féin only for one reason, for peace. And if that's the case...
Well, the same security assessment says that the Army Council are on a peace footing.
Well, if
not on a war footing are the exact words.
And I understand that. If what we said, they run Sinn Féin. But I tell you what, Stephen, they're doing a great job in advising Sinn Féin. Because where I live is thriving. All national areas are thriving. That's run by Sinn Féin. So that's a point I wanted to make to you. Also, I've on your programme many a time, and I think you've agreed with me, that these people are not paramilitaries. They are gangsters. Why can't the media not say that? And that's who the
not
LCC...
Not say what? Not say
that
what?
The LCC represent gangsters.
Well, they're representatives of gangsters, people in the UVF and UDA on the LCC. There are also people in the LCC who are not gangsters, who are wedded to try to get the gangsters to go away.
You always say this, Dave, and I'm not talking about the LCC. I'm talking about the LCC who they represent and talk about and speak for. That's who I'm talking about, not the LCC. And why should politicians? One quick point, Steve.
No. I've got to move on with Brian. Well, of course, we'll talk to you at any time. Robbie Meredith is waiting for us. He's got a good story today. It is that a representative from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland has claimed that some sixth form pupils were called bullies for expressing a view that homosexuality was wrong. Dr. Andrew Brown sits on the Transfer Representatives Council, made the claim to MLAs and Stormont's Education Committee. Dr. Brown said he had been contacted about a workshop run by an outside organisation in a school during Anti-Bullying Week, which takes place every November. Let's have a listen.
Let me give you an example about an organisation that I know about, because somebody contacted me about it. An organisation who went into school during Anti-Bullying Week, and within the first 5 minutes, I had a group of sick formers together. And this was in, no, it doesn't even matter what area or what kind of area it was in Northern Ireland. So the pupils were all asked to raise their hands if they thought that homosexuality was wrong. And some of the pupils raised their hands. This was in the first 5 minutes. And the person who was leading that workshop turned to them in front of everybody else and said, "You're bullies." This was during Anti-Bullying Week. And so those children, those young people, had their own worldviews. I don't know whether it came from a faith position or not, but they had their own worldviews about what their view on homosexuality was. But they were told quite categorically by a visiting group who would also be involved in the delivery of RSC, that believing something made them wrong or made them bullies. So, you know, there are everyone within our school communities, everyone will have a different view on issues to do with sexuality. And this is why our concern is that you have to take the facts with the moral compass and understand that these issues are so sensitive that you can't just get into biology, legality, right, wrong, etc.
Our education arts correspondent Robbie Meredith with us this morning. What are the rules within schools about what people can and can't say to each other, Robbie?
Well, the point was made actually after Andrew Brown spoke by another person representing the Protestant churches at that meeting, Dr. Anita Gracie, that teachers were trained not to allow homophobic slurs or homophobic bullying to be used in schools. That was unacceptable. But I guess the point Dr. Brown was making, and I'm aware, Stephen, that I'm analysing what he said, he's not here to represent himself, I hope I'm not misrepresenting him, was that pupils should be taught in relationships and sexuality education to challenge their own thinking, I suppose, or challenge their own beliefs and the beliefs of others, but they shouldn't just be told they're guilty of thinking wrong things because of their own beliefs. And from the example that he gave, and he didn't name the school and he didn't name the outside organisation, but the example that he gave, it seemed that he was being critical of the fact that these young people had expressed their belief about homosexuality and were immediately told that they were wrong and that they were bullies, rather than being taught to reflect upon their own beliefs or think about what they were saying. But the point was made that actually homophobic slurs or homophobic bullying was wrong and no school should accept that.
So is this about... I'm trying to get my head around this. Is the question this morning about whether children in schools should be able to have the freedom to say homosexuality is wrong or debate it? Because you wouldn't debate, for example, whether someone should sit in a school and be able to say, you know, it's wrong that there's a black child in this class. You wouldn't be able to debate racism. It's just wrong, full stop.
So exactly.
Why debate sexuality?
I'm aware, Stephen, obviously, that I watched this discussion taking place yesterday, but no one who took part in it is actually speaking to you. Again, I think the point was that children should be taught to think critically about their own beliefs, that if a child believes homosexuality is wrong, part of the point of relationship and sexuality education is to, I suppose, get them to think about that, why that's the case, should that be challenged, to expose them to other beliefs and worldviews that wouldn't share what they believe. But I guess, and again, I'm representing Andrew Brown's point. I hope I'm not misrepresenting him. I think the point he was trying to make was that you can't just turn around to a child and say, you're a bully because you believe this. That you can't, you know, basically tell a child they're guilty of wrongthink. And instead, you've got to teach them to perhaps challenge their own beliefs and their own prejudices and their own thinking on these things. That was the point that was being made. And he was a bit worried that when it came to relationship and sex education, as we all know, a lot of schools contract that to outside organisations, that some outside organisations were coming in and labelling children in a certain way for thinking certain things.
And finally, Robbie, is there a stated position from the Department of Education on this?
There is guidance from the Department of Education on relationships and sex education. Obviously, homophobic bullying is wrong. It is bullying if young people are subjected to, say, homophobic slurs. In fact, Pat Sheehan, the Sinn Féin MLA on the committee yesterday, actually raised the question of how, you know, anything homophobic in a school would make a young gay person feel. That's not acceptable. But as you probably know, the guidance around relationship and sex education has become quite messy and a subject of debate, because ultimately it's up to schools to decide what to teach in relationship and sex education depending on their own ethos. And schools now have to teach topics like abortion and things like prevention of early pregnancy, which has been quite controversial.
Robbie, thank you. It's Robbie Meredith, our correspondent. 03030 80 55 55. Back to our top story this morning. Gareth. Morning, Gareth.
Morning, Stephen. Sometimes I would wonder what's been happening over the last 5 years, because we've been talking about Northern Ireland Assembly ministers beating the LCC. But 5 years ago, approximately, we had the security services, we had the Republicans, we had the Loyalists, we had absolutely everybody meeting together in Lambeth Palace in London. So there must have been a plan. There must have been some kind of a deal. There must have been some kind of transition arrangement on offer.
How long does the transitioning continue for?
Well, I don't know, but here we are 5 years later, and even the very security services were meeting with them at Lambeth Palace.
Are we so flush with money in Northern Ireland that there is not a very big pressure to stop the transitioning money as soon as possible?
But it's better to talk than not talk. And who I'm most worried about isn't the so-called old men. It's the next generation. Because you see the people who produced those racist signs outside Rathcoole? They weren't old men. They were people who knew how to do graphic design, who knew how to organise things in a more modern way. Are those the people they need to be talking to? Not just the old men, but the next generation, to try and engender a medium-term perspective, not just reactive,
okay,
not just insecure, a medium-term perspective,
Gareth,
for the whole community,
you.
Stephen.
Thank you very much indeed. Here comes the 10 o'clock news. Thank you, BBC News. Nolan Lives on the iPlayer from last night when we were battling out all the big political issues of the day. We were also talking, the radio show is going to continue to do it, as will this radio show. We are absolutely in touch with you, listening to you about the traffic chaos that there is in Belfast. We hear you loud and clear. I know that the Department of Infrastructure, John's department, John O'Dowd's department, have said that they're looking at what they can do. But the question is, how long are they going to look at it and what are they going to do, isn't it? We're also looking as a programme at the dangerous roads throughout Northern Ireland. We're calling that Nolan's Road Watch. We're asking you to send in some of your examples. You'll see that in the telly show as well, of where you reckon the dangerous roads are throughout Northern Ireland, and hopefully we can team up. But the traffic chaos is one of the most reactive subjects we have done in recent times. It's absolutely bread and butter issue that you are furious about. Nola Live on the BBC iPlayer right now, if you didn't watch it last night. So what we looked at was not only Sydenham Bypass, one lane of it closed at weekends, at the same time as the other traffic disruption that's around Northern Ireland, they're closing the Boyne Bridge. So there's going to be, they're not just closing it, they're demolishing it, they're wiping it out. We'll talk about that in a second. But the reality then is all that traffic coming off the M1, coming down the West Link, they ain't going to get down the Boyne Bridge. It's going to be closed. So what are we facing in the coming months? Chris Souter, prominent entrepreneur, businessman, has been putting Belfast City Council under pressure to increase the attractiveness of the city. He says what we're facing is some businesses going bust. We're hearing from people who won't go anywhere near the city centre hearing about this traffic. Then the other part of this story are those people who are trying to protect the Boyne Bridge, a heritage charity. They've now been threatened, call it what you will, threatened, informed by lawyers representing TransLink's parent company, that if they apply for an injunction to try to delay the demolition of the Boyne Bridge, TransLink will seek financial damages against them. The vice chair of that charity, the Ulster Architectural Heritage Society, is John Anderson. Morning, John.
Morning, Stephen.
It's game over, John. You're applying for an injunction when the decision's been made and you know they're doing it anyway.
Wait a minute, Stephen. Let's talk about traffic first before we talk about heritage. Keeping the bridge solves all of the problems to do with Durham Street and some of the taxi problems at a stroke. Because traffic can continue over the bridge, which is in excellent condition. Taxi pickup and drop-off can take place in the old bus yard at Glengall Street bus station, which is completely full of constructors' vans at the moment. And pedestrians can access the new station from Great Victoria Street without having to cross a road.
But they don't need the bridge anymore, do they? We don't need anything to go under it anymore, so they're flattening it.
Pedestrians can go under it without having to cross roads the way they're having to do now and the way they will have to do. The question that nobody has asked Minister O'Dowd is, why are you demolishing the bridge and spending more millions doing it when the bridge can actually function with the new station and give pedestrians and visitors to Belfast?
Are they not? And look, we'll go to the department and ask them why. We should have done that. That's my fault. Why are they flattening that bridge? But it's certainly been suggested to me that area, when they flatten the bridge, is going to create space for drop-off areas for taxis and things. Is it not?
No, it's not. What they're doing is they're removing the bridge and they're replacing it with a straight road. Now, why are they doing that?
Because nobody needs to go under it, John.
But the original plan stated that the new station be accessed by pedestrians directly from Great Victoria Street. Now, the only way to do that for pedestrians is to go in below the bridge. The bridge is already there. The bridge is in perfect condition. The bridge is a brilliant example of Belfast industrial heritage. It's the last example of railway heritage in central Belfast. Why are they not including the bridge in the plan? Why spend millions in removing the bridge when the bridge can actually solve all the problems?
Well, I don't know, but we'll try to find out.
We have been trying to find that out for 7 years, and you cannot get at senior management in DFI or in TransLink. What you get is talking to PR people who don't know anything about anything and cannot answer questions.
Well, they know about when PR,
when we write to senior management in TransLink, and when we write to the minister, and we're going to publish these letters and the replies, what we get is arrogance and rudeness.
Well, I doubt now you're getting rudeness from a ministerial department. You're interpreting it like that, but you're describing it as rude when they don't give you the answer you want.
Is it rude when you write directly to the minister with a lot of legitimate questions, and what you get is a reply, if you could call it that, from the TransLink liaison unit in DFI, which I gather employs 20 or 30 people, which just basically gives you back the TransLink line? In other words, we're right, you're wrong, we're doing this, and we don't want to answer any of your legitimate questions. That's what we're up against. We're, you know, we're a respected built heritage charity with 57 years of experience. And as I said to Buckler, every now and again, we have to take a deep breath, take a risk, and challenge authority. And we have done this in the past with judicial reviews and so on, and we are always proved right, because there is no scrutiny on stuff like that. The catastrophic and cumulative loss of built and industrial heritage, which is an asset to Northern Ireland. You know, I was talking to Chris Souter yesterday, and we were talking about why people come to visit cities. People come to visit cities.
Well, they don't come to Belfast to see the Boyne Bridge.
No, but they come to Belfast.
I've never looked at that bridge in my life. What's so special about it?
That's because you weren't able to look at it. The thing now with it opened up is you will be able to look at it.
Well, then do what? You look at a pile of bricks on a bridge. Do what?
No. It's difficult to explain.
I'd rather look at a face supper, some people might argue.
Get out of here.
What is so special about the Boyne Bridge? Tell me.
On a radio program, we need to be in below the bridge. We need to be over the bridge with a camera. Translink won't allow us to do that. So, the bridge is the last remaining example of Harland & Wolff's craft engineering in the middle of Belfast. So, if you're coming in to this world-class station from anywhere, what are you going to see when you walk through to Great Victoria Street under the bridge? You're going to see this amazing example of engineering. On the other hand, if you go over the top of the bridge, you're going to see art and culture in the design of the bridge. It is a beautiful bridge. You need to look at the bridge to appreciate it.
How can a bridge be beautiful?
If this bridge was in London, Transport for London celebrate their bridges. They invite people to look at them and marvel at the Victorian. This is 1930. Of course they do. Of course they do. Railway heritage is enormously profitable all over the world. No, what I'm talking about here is not nostalgia. It's not us being nerdy. It's about future profit for Belfast.
Well, the plan.
If you turn Belfast into a clone city, which is what is happening now, who wants to visit it?
Well, it's about having a state-of-the-art transport hub, for a start. We've found, actually, copy from the newspaper. And they're saying, when was that? When did the newsletter print that? Was that last year?
It was the 8th. You're talking about
September.
The old copy. We sent you that. It was the 18th of December, 1936.
No. In the 12th of September, the newsletter, right? They're reporting the plan is to create a plaza called Saltwater Square next to where the bridge now stands. That'll be open space leading up to new Grand Central Station. So we're going to be getting Saltwater Square.
Saltwater Square is a platform of Chinese granite. You know, really? Is that Belfast? The bridge, apart from being attractive and valuable in its own right, the bridge contains the original 1640 bridge, the first bridge in Belfast, and the later Boyne Bridge. Those are built into the fabric of that bridge. No city in the world, no European city, and certainly not across the water, would be demolishing this. It is crazy. And has John O'Dowd sanctioned the threat to us, an established built heritage charity working in the public interest? Has John O'Dowd sanctioned this? We need to know that.
Now, what you're talking about now is you're going to be attempting to stop them demolishing the bridge by applying for a court injunction to do so. And
yeah.
TransLink have replied to you saying what?
Well, the solicitor's letter just punts the same old line. We've got planning permission. We're going to do it. Well, that's stupid.
Well, it's quite an important line, isn't it? Planning permission is the democratic way we decide whether something is in the interest of our community or not.
Who gave them planning permission?
The planners.
No, DFI. DFI
do not sign off planning.
Oh, yes, they do. DFI strategic planning sign off on major planning applications.
Okay.
And this is a major planning application. DFI also finance TransLink, and they are the sponsor of TransLink. So the whole thing is a loop. Where's the scrutiny?
Well, look, I'm sure Sinn Féin would rather talk about bridges and heritage than Michael McMonagall. I'm sure they would want to talk about bridges and heritage rather than talking about heading out at the British Heart Foundation as they did. So have you asked, this is an important question, have you asked Minister O'Dowd to meet you? And what have they said?
When I get back to my computer, I will send you the correspondence with Minister O'Dowd, which will explain this exactly. Now, what you say is interesting. They would prefer to talk about built heritage than the McMonagall affair. Well, if Sinn Féin, now, bear in mind, Sinn Féin is an all-Ireland party. And the Boyne Bridge is Irish heritage as much as it is Ulster heritage, whatever you want to say. This isn't political. The Boyne Bridge is situated on the island of Ireland. Sinn Féin is an all-Ireland party. In the Republic, there is a 30-year built heritage strategy, which Sinn Féin buy into. So why are they not buying into it up here? And I will send you the correspondence with the minister, and you can ask whatever questions you wish.
Well, look, we will also ask the department if they're prepared to meet up with you and chat to you.
We'd be more than happy with that. But what we're not happy with is, as I say, what we've had in the past, what we're getting now, which is belligerence. You know, we're a small charity. They're threatening, the figure in that letter, which you'll see, is £100,000 of costs a week. Now, that would put us out of extinction. And they wouldn't get any money because we don't have any money. So the whole thing is ludicrous. It is, could you say, bullying?
Well, if you are taking legal action, they're prepared, they're entitled to take legal redress. And if that includes compensation to protect the public purse, that is not bullying. If you're going down the legal route, so can they.
Ah, but hold on. How much are they spending to demolish the bridge? And why are they spending that money to demolish the bridge? That is a question that has never been answered.
By the way, you're 100% right. I'm just looking at this. It's my bad. TransLink are confirming it was the Department of Infrastructure gave the planning permission. They say it was granted for Belfast Central Station by the Department for Infrastructure March 2019. They said we're committed to preserving and celebrating the history and heritage of the area and continue to work closely with the local community to repurpose key elements of the bridge for significant artworks. Who in the local community are they speaking to?
We're back to the City Hall door handle analogy. You know, we'll knock down the City Hall, but we'll keep the door handles and we'll put it into a sculpture. And that means every visitor to Belfast will marvel at the City Hall door handles. You know,
who in the local community are they speaking to? I need to ask them that. Who?
Pardon? Sorry. Well, I mean, you can speak to former Mayor Billy Dixon, who represents a large community.
No, they say they're speaking to the local community. They say that. So I wonder, I'm going to find out from...
Well, I'll tell you how they do this. I'll tell you how they do this. And this is common in public consultation, so-called. What they do is they get a PR agency. They get very whizzy computer graphics of happy, shiny people walking in whatever particular development. They bring the local community in and they say, look at this. It's absolutely marvellous. We're going to spend millions and millions and millions of pounds and you will all be happy. And if you're bringing in just ordinary people off the street, they look at that and they'll say, yeah, that's great. That's great. But what TransLink and DFI Who they don't want to talk to is people that can actually get below that and see, look, you haven't thought sideways. You haven't thought... All the departments and TransLink sign into a protocol. And that protocol is to protect the government historic estate. Now, the Boyne Bridge is part of the government historic estate.
Tell me this. Have you got political support for your position?
No.
Have you reached out to the different political parties?
The politics here have no policy with Built Heritage.
Well, maybe I don't know, John. Maybe you should reach out to the UVA and UVF, and you might be able to get support from them, and then maybe DUP ministers might come in behind you. I don't know.
From what I understand from rumour, those particular bodies may well have been part of the public consultation.
Okay. All right. John, thank you. We'll continue watching this story. Thank you. Our last story this morning, it's back. It's back with Top Gear star Freddie Flintoff presenting it. But is it going to be as good as when Jim Bowen was doing it? Commentator Mike Parry's with us this morning, repeating this stuff and trying to make it as good as it was in the past. Mike, is it going to work?
Well, that's always the problem, isn't it, when you bring an old programme back? I mean, take, for instance, All Creatures Great and Small, right? They've made a remake of that series recently. I'm old enough to remember the first series, and I thought it was brilliant, and I don't think the second series can overtake it. But what you've got here with Bullseye, you've got the concept of a game, which was brilliant. Jim Bowen did it from 1981 to 95, and it was largely his show. And I think, you know, when Jim had to give up doing it, then the show sort of died with him. But Freddie Flintoff is a very, very fine TV presenter. I don't know whether you've seen the recent stuff he's done, Field of Dreams and all that kind of stuff.
No, I haven't seen a job. No.
Yeah, well, he'll liven it up if anybody can do it. Remember, it's coming back only as a Christmas special. They did revive it in 2006 for a couple of series, but it didn't capture the public's imagination.
Flop.
But it was a bit of a flop, yeah. But now this latest proposal is a Christmas special this year with the hopes that the production company have done it will then be commissioned to give it a full run of the series. I hope they do. It was a brilliant programme. I was of an age, sort of mid-20s or something like that. We used to sit around, have a few beers and watch it. It was fantastic. Giving away ridiculous prizes like speedboats to people who lived in council flats and all that kind of stuff, you know, which was made it so unique.
It's you know, is the format really that special? Was it not all down to Jim Bowen?
Well, it was down to Jim Bowen, you know, Bully, and that fantastic northern accent he had. He had an accent from northern England, you know, which nobody could ever mistake. You know, Jim Bowen, yeah, Bully, come and see us, you know, and all that kind of stuff. A bit like a Coronation Street character, so to speak. But as a former darts champion myself, because I won the darts championship at my university.
As soon as I saw that wee pot belly of yours, I knew you were into darts.
Oh, nothing to do with Potbelly, mate. They used to call me Dead Eye Dick because I was brilliant at hitting bullseyes, funny enough, as we're talking about bullseye, right?
Dick.
Yeah, Dead Eye Dick, yeah. And
why do you call Dick if your name's Mike?
Well, because it was just rhymed, Dead Eye Dick. Dead Eye Mike didn't sound quite as good. So when I used to...
Some people
walk
call
into
me
the...
Dick too.
Yeah, well, when I used to walk into the competition arena, which was at a pub near my university, the University of Trent, there was a cheer in the crowd. Here comes Dead Eye Dick, because I was so good at hitting the treble 20 and the bullseye. So what I'm saying is, as an appreciate, as a man who appreciates darts to an enormous extent, I thought they got a wonderful blend there of a bit of laughable darts from amateurs and a quiz show. Everybody loves quiz shows. Put the two together, you've got Bullseye. It was brilliant. I hope it comes back. It'll be brilliant again.
Michael in Belfast, would you hear this? Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Stephen. I have a wee anecdote. I have a very good friend. I'll name him Kieran Adams. He and his brother appeared in Bullseye many years ago and won a car. But a funny story was...
We'll try to find that. If we could find that, it would be good, wouldn't it? What type of car was it?
I'm not going to source it myself. But a funny story, he told a very funny joke to whoever the guy, Jim's PA... And the guy came back and said, "Sorry, Kieran, Jim does the jokes." It was a very good joke. Do you want to hear the joke? No?
No.
Why not? It's a very clean joke. It's funny.
Okay.
Right. He said, "What hobbies have you got?" He says, "Well, I like reading, I like writing, I like running, I like watching the TV, and I like paper turning." So what he says was, "I read the form in the paper, I run to the
bookies." I wish I had a stuff to know.
I write the docket, and I watch my horse lose, and I rip up the docket. And he said, "No, Jim does the jokes." There you go.
What was the joke?
Was that a joke?
Yeah. Apparently, Jim Bowen. Look, this was all Michael and Mike.
A joke.
All right, no,
sorry.
Thank you.
All right, bye bye.
Here, no, do you know what I'll do? I'll do Butler's false laugh. Ha ha ha! There we go. Does that keep you happy?
No, not really, no.
Here, Michael, before you go, I read an article years ago, and Mike Parr, I don't know if you know this about this or whatever, that here's working class Jim Bowen, right? And a few years into the show, he would arrive in his Rolls Royce. Yeah. Now, I don't know. I've no idea if that's true or not, but he certainly, that propelled him into major stardom, didn't it? And rightly so, he's a talented man.
Yeah, but actually, in those days, Northern comedians all had Rolls Royces. Do you remember Bernard, what's his name, who ran the club in Manchester? You know,
Manning.
Big fat guy. Bernard Manning, yeah, he had a Rolls Royce. Jimmy Tarbuck had a Rolls Royce. It became the thing for Northern comedians to have a Rolls Royce. Jimmy Tarbuck's Rolls Royce, by the way, had the registration plate of COM1C.
Wow.
And it was a thing Northern comedians used to do as a sort of, you know, snub to the upper classes. We're working class boys, but we can drive around in Rolls Royces.
Yeah. I drive a Skoda. What's that say about me?
Yeah, very good. But I'm looking forward to the return of Bullseye.
What other shows should we bring
on,
back?
If it comes on, I'm going to volunteer to go on it. Well, this is the problem, bringing shows back and making them as good as what they were before. I mean, funnily enough, at the moment, I'm watching reruns of whatever became of the Likely Lads, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is brilliant. There was the original Likely Lads in black and white, and then the follow-up show, whatever became of the Likely Lads. But you've got to have, you know, the same two actors, Rodney Bewes and who's the other one? James somebody. And I don't think you could replicate that. But this is a format. It, you know, you don't need the originals if you can get somebody to perform as well as Jim Bowen did. And I think Freddie Flintoff will.
I'm just, when I'm thinking of shows that should come back, it's bringing me back to my childhood now. I used to have a Bodie and Doyle wee holster and a gun.
From the
professionals.
Yeah.
And in those days when I was a child, Belfast City Centre was still zoned off. You had to go through the turnstiles and be searched. And here was me as this wee 6 and 7 year old child, because I was watching the professionals with mum and dad, I'd be getting into the city centre with a wee plastic gun under my armpit.
Yeah. But you were popular.
I know.
Yeah.
Brings back my childhood. Mike, thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks everyone for listening today. My goodness, I saw selection boxes in the shops yesterday. It's nearly Christmas. October the 10th. We'll see you tomorrow, Friday the 11th, for another program. And look after yourselves in between. Thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.